Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today I'll be taking time to speak with Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and economist Diane Lim. Lim will be joining us for the next installation of our newest recurring segment, The Economist Mom. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. After months of waiting, a plan due next month to overhaul the budget process may not produce much of an overhaul at all. Leadership has begun downplaying expectations over what could be produced from the Joint Select Committee on Budget and Appropriations Process Reform. While the panel appears to have consensus in moving toward a two-year budget cycle, it has splintered on many other proposals. The Treasury has released the final deficit numbers for fiscal year 2018 at $779 billion. The deficit is 17% higher than last year's, and it is the largest deficit since 2012 when it topped $1 trillion. As a result, President Trump, who promised to eliminate the federal debt within 8 years, called on his cabinet to cut an additional 5% from all agency budget requests, which are currently being drafted for the upcoming fiscal year 2020. By way of example, an across-the-board cut of 5% of all discretionary spending this year would amount to about $62 billion. That would be a drop in the bucket for even this year's deficit, and would still be a tall order because appropriators on both sides of the aisle are expected to push for increased, not decreased, funding. And if the president's suggested 5% trim would be applied to cuts he's already discussed for fiscal year 2020 as opposed to current spending levels, non-defense discretionary spending could shrink from $597 billion this year to $445 billion next year, a whopping 25% cut. According to the president, even the military may not be spared. Speaking of defense spending, projections show that by 2023, we will spend more on interest on the debt than the entire defense budget. Interest costs rose by $62 billion in fiscal year 2018 to over $324 billion, a nearly 24% jump over last year. Perhaps even more alarming, the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO, released an alternative scenario which reflects current policy trends as opposed to existing law, and assumes discretionary spending caps are again raised and expiring tax cuts get extended through the recently proposed Tax Reform 2.0 package. The report projects that within 20 years, interest payments will consume nearly a third of all federal revenue, growing from 9.7% in the fiscal year 2018 budget to 31.8% in 2038. Up next, economist Diane Lim will join me and Concord's executive director Bob Bixby for the next installation of our newest segment, The Economist Mom. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by economist Diane Lim and Concord's executive director Bob Bixby. Bob is a familiar voice on the show, and Diane is now a regular contributor in this recurring segment called The Economist Mom. Diane is a principal at the District Economics Group. She also teaches courses in behavioral economics and tax policy at George Washington University in Georgetown. Diane was Concord's chief economist from 2008 to 2012, and she's been with other prestigious organizations like CBO, Brookings, Pew, CED, as well as the House Budget and the Ways and Means Committees. Diane received her PhD in economics from the University of Virginia. her master's from Brown, and a bachelor's from the University of Michigan. Welcome back, Bob and Diane, as we continue the Economist Mom segment.
Thanks, Chase.
Thanks.
We've gone into detail on how some things work, like deficit financing and tax cuts in past segments, and I wanted to do something a little different this time around and leverage your years of experience together and look at the timing of economic and budget policy during presidential administrations, especially since many people look back over history with that sort of political or leadership filter. So, Diane, I want to start maybe with the Clinton administration, since that's sort of where your experience began and is also the last era where we even had any balanced budgets. So maybe give us a quick summary or snapshot of what the economic climate was during the Clinton era, and what kind of policy proposals were being pursued at that time.
So, Clinton administration, you know, he won the White House having had to debate a guy named Ross Perot, and deficits were high at the time as a share of GDP. Maybe Bob knows how high they were as a share of GDP. But they were running pretty high at the end of the at the beginning of the Clinton administration, and it had become a campaign issue. And there was this feeling that the large deficits were a drain, were serving as a drain on our economy, particularly the supply side of the economy. And there was evidence that it was putting a squeeze on the economy because we saw high interest rates at the time. So when Bill Clinton took the White House, he had to kind of dial back a little bit on his inclination maybe to promise a lot of middle-class tax cuts during the campaign. And because he had tried to address the issues of concern that Ross Perot had brought up so effectively during the campaign, he came into the White House acknowledging that the deficit was a problem and that it was necessary to kind of be a little bit more disciplined in terms of tax cuts and spending going forward in his administration. And so, Bob, that was the same time that the Concord Coalition was beginning.
To answer your question, the deficit was 4.5% of GDP in 92. That was during the year that the campaign was going on. And that's pretty big. I mean, we're not there yet. Despite the trillion-dollar deficit that people are talking about, that's not as big as a percentage of the economy. We're 3.9%, I think, last year, and headed up to that range of 4.5. But if you begin to think about where the Clinton administration came in and where the Concord Coalition came in, there was an alarming period of recurring deficits going on. And that was that's obviously gave birth to the Concord Coalition. The interesting thing is that I sometimes get this, you know, because the Concord Coalition has been around for 26 years now, people say things like, well, you know, you can't do anything about the deficit. It's just, you know, it's going to keep going up. And what can you do about it? Politicians are irresponsible and blah, blah, blah. And sure, there's some of that. But what people tend to forget is that for about 10 straight years, starting in 92, the budget picture actually improved. Every year, the deficit got a little bit smaller, and then it turned into a surplus, and the surplus got bigger every year. So roughly from around 92 to 2001, when there was a mild recession, the budget picture improved every year. And that was that didn't just happen. you know, there was a mix of good policy and good luck, and there was some bipartisan cooperation. So one thing it proved to me was that you don't need a balanced budget amendment to the Constitution, because I came in to that era thinking that you probably did, that there's no way you could ever get the hard choices made without a constitutional amendment. And I wrote op-eds to that effect when I was field director of the Concord Coalition in the mid-90s. And my attitude now is that period from 92 to 2001 proved that you did not need a constitutional amendment. You needed economic growth, and you needed spending restraint, and you needed more revenues than we tend to get. And that happens. So,
and you needed bipartisanship.
Yeah, and you needed bipartisanship to make it all happen.
And I don't want to. I want to jump in real quick, Bob. I don't want to gloss over those two pretty significant issues. I want to jump back to Diane's point where she mentioned when the Clinton administration came in, we were already dealing with deficits and growing interest rates. And Bob, you just mentioned that after 92, we had 10 years of improvement. So, could both of you sort of break down how we got to the point of larger deficits in 92, and then specifically what policies or what avenues of economic growth helped to reduce those deficits and get us to a point of surplus?
Well, so during the course of the Reagan administration, there had been, we had enacted some tax cuts. So we had, intentional tax cuts. We had also growing entitlement spending from the Social Security and Medicare programs, which were all expected, of course, because, the growing deficits in Social Security and Medicare, or the reduced balance in the Social Security and Medicare funds, is largely because of the demographic factor, that there's a swell of population in the baby boom generation, those people born between 1946 and 1964. So there was a coincidence of, more people coming into retirement years at the same time that tax revenues had been relatively flat. During the Reagan administration, taxes had been cut, but then they were kind of reversed a little bit in the mid-80s. And Tax Reform Act of 86, which is what a lot of economists consider the last fundamental tax reform that took place, was a revenue-neutral reform, not a tax cut. So, but we came into the beginning of the Clinton administration with pressures on both sides of the budget, in other words. Like, revenues were not as high as they probably should have been. And spending was continuing to grow, driven by the largest of the government programs. So it was kind of a normal story for why our deficits why we had been running deficits for, decades, is because revenues were not keeping pace with entitlement programs. And I think that when the Clinton administration came in, the first thing they realized is that there was a case to be made to raise revenues, not just to kind of keep revenues going along the path that they were going, but to actually legislate a tax increase. And of course, that was very controversial at the time because Republicans still didn't like the idea of raising taxes, even if they didn't like the deficit. And they were very much opposed to the idea of raising taxes, tax rates in particular, because they made the argument that it was going to kill the economy, that it was going to have adverse effects on the size of the economy. And so a deficit reduction policy that raised marginal tax rates was likely to be counterproductive, that you're trying to do this to reduce the deficit, but you're going to kill the economy, so the tax base is going to shrink, so you're going to not get more revenue, you're going to get less revenue. So that was sort of, a supply-side tax policy argument that, we don't want to just reduce the deficit by raising tax rates because there's this adverse effect on economic activity. It didn't turn out that way, though.
No, what strikes me about having lived through it in slow motion and now looking back on it is that revenue growth was substantial during that time. And where we were successful on the spending side was defense spending, mm-hmm. because that was the peace dividend. George Herbert Walker Bush referred to that at the end of the Cold War, saying that we were going to have a peace dividend, and he was right about that. He didn't stay in office long enough to experience it much himself. But certainly, if you look at the numbers, defense spending came down quite a bit as a percentage of the economy during that time. So you had defense spending not rising by as much as it had in the past, and revenues going up. And of course, the economy, far from being killed, had a long period of economic growth. You know, some, this is an uncomfortable statistic for some, but the years where the budget was in surplus, in all of those years, the revenue as a percentage of the economy was far higher than it normally is, like over 19%, even reaching 20% of GDP before the recession hit. And it really, you know, normally you get like 17.5% of GDP is where revenues tend to be. We've had a lot lower in some of the subsequent years. But anyway, the point is, given where spending tends to come out by consensus and autopilot, you do need around 19 to 20% of GDP to come anywhere close to a balanced budget. We had that at the end of the Clinton administration. That's why we had a balanced budget. We're far from it now.
Yeah, and I think revenues did come up to that high of a level for a combination of the legislative and economic reasons, that, you know, revenues as a share of GDP always grow when the economy grows in real terms, because the tax system is indexed for inflation, but it's not indexed so much that it takes away any real economic growth. And so whenever we experience strong economic growth, particularly strong economic growth at the top of the income distribution at the highest marginal tax rates, we naturally get a growth in revenues as a share of our economy. So it was a combination of the fact that we had raised marginal tax rates at the top in the, you know, 93 tax increases, and we hadn't raised tax rates so much that the worries of supply side economists came true. We didn't stifle economic growth. In fact, the increase in public saving combined with pretty stable private saving. So national saving in the economy had grown, and national saving is good for kind of that supply side economic growth. It grows the capacity of our economy. And then we had a little luck thrown in there. There was this thing called that irrational exuberance that Alan Greenspan would talk about the stock market kind of going nuts over the tech stocks. And so we had capital gains and dividends, you know, coming in at very high, surprisingly high rates in terms of CBO. CBO was year after year, another April surprise. We weren't expecting this much capital gains and dividends revenue, but we weren't expecting this much capital gains and dividends in the economy. So it was a combination of the policy that raised marginal tax rates without hurting the economy, the strong growth in the economy, a little bit of windfall growth in the economy from the tech bubble that eventually burst right at the end of the Clinton administration. And so we knew some of that growth in revenue was going to be fleeting, but some of it was more permanent. It had the tax system been left as it was at the end of the Clinton administration, we would have continued to have a pretty healthy level of revenues as a share of GDP relative to our spending.
And Bob, just before we get too far down the road here, we're halfway through the segment. I just want to remind people of who we're talking to. This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and economist Diane Lim in our now recurring segment, The Economist Mom. And we're discussing economic and budget policy through presidential administrations. And I'll let you make your final point there, Bob, but then I want to move on to talking about the George W. Bush era, which it sounds like we were starting to transition to. But all of everything you just said sort of solidified the thought I've always had, and that was, you know, there's not a hard line between presidential administrations. There's always sort of this blending of policies between one and the other, and later presidents had to deal with the policy ramifications of earlier presidents. And I think we can get a little more into that, but I'll hand it back over to you.
Well, just to make a political point, where we were politically at the end of the Clinton administration was really kind of interesting on the budget front, is that we had these burgeoning surpluses, and the question was what to do with it. And there was a lot of talk about savings and paying down the debt and how we could pre-position for the retirement of the baby boom generation and whether you could, you know, how the government could best invest. And people tend to forget Alan Greenspan at that time was worried about paying off the debt too fast. And what were we going to do without a government debt? How would they run the bond market? So it was an entirely different era. And before we got too deeply into what will we do with the surplus, suddenly we didn't need to worry about it anymore. So that will give you your
suddenly
your
enter
cue.
George W. Bush, right?
Yeah. So let's dive into that. What happened all of a sudden? I know going into the Clinton administration, we had this sort of mini demographic shift. And then at the end of the Clinton administration, we had a couple policy changes and then an upswing in economic growth where we saw balanced budgets and even surplus. And then a few years later, all the projections suddenly shifted. So what caused that shift?
I don't know. Diane was sitting there in the White House at that time. So, Diane, what happened?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. So, I was in the working at the White House at the end of the Clinton administration and the first 100 days of the George W. Bush administration. So what happened was George W. Bush, when he was a candidate, had campaigned very, very heavily on a tax cut agenda. I think at the time he was probably calling it tax reform, but it ended up by the time he actually went into the White House, it became very clear immediately that this was not going to be a revenue neutral tax reform, that this was going to be a major tax cut. And at the time, Alan Greenspan actually helped the political case for the Bush tax cuts, because he came in and testified before Congress and basically said that it wasn't appropriate to run, like, this was too much of a surplus. It's sort of like easy come, easy go. It's like, first you were complaining we were running too big a deficit, so now you're complaining that we're running surpluses. And it's like, you know, so he testified before Congress that for the economy, it would actually make sense that the government wouldn't run so much of a surplus. And, you know, of course, those of us who had worked as economists for the Clinton administration and had tried to make the case at the end of the administration that the surpluses that were accumulating were necessary to prepare for what we knew would otherwise be kind of massively growing deficits as the baby boom generation continued to retire, and, you know, as they continue to leave the workforce and therefore reduce the supply side of the economy naturally.
There was a good case for a tax cut to be made in 2001, but it wasn't the sort of tax cut that the Bush administration was proposing. There was a sort of a mild recession, the bursting of the tech bubble. Mm-hmm. I can remember, during the Clinton administration, there hadn't been a recession. There hadn't been a recession since the Concord Coalition started. So the question was always, well, what do we do now with this deficit and debt reduction stuff if we ever have a surplus? If we ever have a recession. Someday there's going to be a recession. We're going to have to deal with it. So our conclusion was, okay, we are running a big surplus here, very big, and so there is a justification for some sort of tax cut, but not a large and escalating tax cut. The way the Bush tax cut was structured, it was supposed to get bigger every 2 years. And that struck us as making no sense to lock in a long-term escalating tax cut when you didn't know what your needs were going to be. So we fought it on that grounds, but we said, look, there is a justification for a timely, temporary, targeted, I think those were the terms, tax cut that would essentially treat the recession, but not screw up, for lack of a more technical term, the long-term structural favorable dynamics that had been put in play.
From a tax cut that sounds like it went too far, which sounds oddly familiar for present day, you brought up 2001, and I wanted to ask, like, what role has spending on post 9/11 foreign conflicts played in this in terms of driving spending or potential deficits? And then I also wanted to acknowledge the fact that I feel like there was a momentous shift in public perception between the Clinton era and the Bush era in terms of how budget policy is perceived or even viewed by the average voter. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that as well.
Well, let me just jump in on the first point, because 9/11 was obviously a very significant date, and it really did have the effect of loosening fiscal policy, which is fine. You don't, I mean, in the, I can remember watching the horrible events of that day and thinking, you don't worry about the budget at this time. You do, you know, you do whatever it takes.
Silly,
and you don't, you don't say, oh my goodness, you know, there's a budget cap here. We're going to have to deal with that. And, but again, like the recession, it did have the practical implication of getting people out of the habit of thinking about spending and some constraint on spending. So it both gave a reason, a very logical reason, to spend more. And the concern was that the concern of budget watchers like us was that it would be, you would never get that discipline back, kind of like falling off a diet for people that have ever tried to do that or quit smoking or something. Once the, you know, the, once you lose the discipline, it's very difficult to get it back.
But spending to, for a war is obviously very different from, you know, spending to commit to a new entitlement program,
right,
or a permanent tax cut. And so just like Concord was, you know, supportive of the idea of putting in place a temporary tax cut to help combat the recession, you know, you would say, well, the war is obviously a type of emergency.
I can remember getting a call from a budget reporter on the Hill saying, aren't you concerned about the spending? That we're? And I said, no.
Well,
do whatever it takes.
For the war?
I mean, like,
I mean, do you remember at the time Larry Lindsay? Larry Lindsay was the National Economic Council director at the time for the George W. Bush administration. And he was asked how much it would cost to go to war in response to 9/11. And it was not that
billion.
Much. I
he
thought
said,
it was like 100 to 150 or something. And people were like,
they
like,
said, oh, crazy. It'll like, never cost that much.
right.
And but the other thing is, because you mentioned, Chase, the, you know, despite all of that, it's important to remember that defense spending has never come up to Cold War levels since then.
Right.
It, despite the two long engagements in Iraq and Afghanistan, and, you know, defense spending did top 4% of GDP. But during the Cold War, it was more like 6 or 7%. I mean, it was high. It was over 6% of GDP. So, and I think now it's somewhere around 3% of GDP. It's 3.5%, something like that. So, in terms of what it has its long term effect been, it's really not.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's billions of dollars, and I know people don't like to hear this, that that's not a big deal, because it is obviously a big deal with several hundred billion dollars. But in terms of when you look at the long-term structural outlook for the budget, it really hasn't altered the picture that much.
And Bob, I just wanted to jump in here real quick. I know you mentioned that, you know, billions of dollars in the grand scheme of things on a war or international conflict isn't necessarily a huge amount of money in the big picture, but people still care about billions of dollars, hopefully. So my question is, was there any effort to pay for this new conflict in Iraq and Afghanistan? And I also want to get the conversation back to sort of the public perspective and how the view had shifted on deficits.
Well, if you're going to war, your first decision is, what is the reason for going to war and why are you going to do it? Is it in the national interest? You don't think about the budget, because if it's a legitimate reason, you go and borrow the money and worry about it later. So I would concede that. But you do eventually have to pay for it somewhere down the road. Traditionally, we have done so by raising taxes or cutting other spending. Other presidents have dealt with that way. The unreality that was going on at that time, you had the one of the House leaders, a fellow by the name of Tom DeLay, in the House announced that the way we were going to pay for the war was to cut taxes.
To cut taxes.
Yes, which I always thought was just like taking that supply side theory to just a bizarre extreme. And that's the environment that we were in those days.
Well, in fact, every economic development, there was spin put on it saying, yep, see, this is another reason why we have to cut taxes. We're in a recession. We have to cut taxes. We're running a surplus. Have to cut taxes.
We need to finance the war.
Cut taxes. Yeah.
And I think one of the phrases I vaguely remember hearing coming out of the Bush administration was the idea that deficits don't matter anymore. And I think that might have been a verbatim quote. Who said that?
I believe that was Vice President Dick Cheney who said that, you know, because the deficit became, it was an inconvenient truth going on at the time. It was like, you know, the Bush administration wanted to push their large tax cut. They wanted to not be constrained in terms of military spending to address the war. So, you know, I think that that just became an inconvenience that was like they did not want to be the party anymore of that talked about what a problem deficits were for the economy.
So, in their credit, the administration did push Social Security reform, but it was out of context. I mean, it wasn't like a big part of a grand fiscal strategy. It was kind of an isolated thing, and so it didn't really catch on because it just seemed unrelated to anything else.
I want to jump in there, Bob, on the policy perspective. You know, we talked about tax cuts here and spending on defense and military. What were some of the other policy agenda items that were pushed during the Bush era? And Diane, maybe a question for you. It seems like we didn't really feel the economic effects of growing deficits during that time. And I wonder why that is.
Well, let me just give you the trifecta of what I think the worst year for fiscal responsibility. And I think it was 2004. Simultaneously that year, Congress went to war. They, that was when the Iraq War was launched about that time to go along with what we had already started in Afghanistan. And the Congress also, with the administration's support, passed a prescription drug benefit to Medicare, which was a major entitlement expansion, and topped it off with another major tax cut. So we have the trifecta here. More defense spending, we're going to go to war, add a new entitlement, and cut taxes. That was a very frustrating year, I can tell you, for deficit people.
And yet, you know, the American public was not very concerned. They didn't see anything going on in their daily lives that that was a reason to be concerned that deficits were affecting their pocketbooks, because we no longer were having that nice connection or that, you know, the price connection between deficits and interest rates that we had seen during the Clinton years and the George H.W. Bush years. So we no longer could see the evidence that deficit spending ended up crowding out the capital that's available to the economy as a whole, which ends up putting capital in shortage in the economy as a whole and raising interest rates. So, and the reason why, despite all this deficit spending, we did not face a shortage of capital supply in the U.S. was because of two other factors. One was that the rest of the world was actually lending a lot of money to us, because in the rest of the world, they were doing a lot of their own saving that exceeded their, you know, more saving relative to their income than we were doing in the U.S. Privately. And so there was a lot of foreign capital that was coming in to invest in the U.S. Secondly, monetary policy was very accommodative during the entirety of the George W. Bush administration. Basically, as deficits were growing and as interest rates might have normally naturally risen with the shortage of the capital stock, the Fed was putting more money into the economy. So we had more capital coming from abroad. We had more capital coming from the Fed. and that kept interest rates down. And so a lot of people, a lot of my friends, when I worked on these budget issues and during the George W. Bush administration, they'd say, what do you do for a job? And I'd say, well, I work about the economic effects of the budget deficit, you know. And they were like, what economic effects? What does the why do I have to care about the budget deficit? And it became very difficult talking about that to ordinary people and explaining that this is a cost that will ultimately have to be paid back, because the lack of an immediate cost became a problem, because suddenly it became sort of a longer term problem, not a problem that we had to worry about right now.
So, Bob and Dan, we're actually running short on time, which means we're going to end up getting to the Obama administration and the first couple of years of the Trump administration, likely in the next Economist Mom segment. But before we go, I wanted to ask a question specifically of you, Bob. In the face of a turn in public opinion when it came to fiscal policy and the realization that large budget deficits were on the horizon and likely to grow, how did the Concord Coalition respond to that to try and get in the game and effect change?
Well, I can remember a specific policy forum in Washington that I was attending, and the Comptroller General of the United States, a fellow by the name of David Walker, was there also. And he kind of caught my eye, and he said he wanted to talk to me, and we went to the back of the room, and he said, you know, I think we need to hit the road. I think we need to. This is, I mean, people just aren't talking about this issue, and the people in Washington aren't even acknowledging it. And I said, you know, that sounds great to me. Is that, you know, I mean, you're the Comptroller General of the United States. You're the chief accounting officer. Is that something that you want to do? And he said, yes, that's how I feel I can serve the country. He's an independent officer. He's not beholden to one party or the other. And so we also then, I was working with somebody from Brookings and somebody from Heritage who are perceived as more progressive and more conservative, and a woman named Belle Sawhill, a scholar named Belle Sawhill, and a colleague from Heritage, Stuart Butler. They were simultaneously looking at doing something together just to show that, you know, progressives and conservatives could at least agree on the facts. And so I asked Bell and Stewart if they would like to join David and I in we started calling it the fiscal wake-up tour, and going around to college campuses around the country, like about one a month, and talking to the media and trying to raise the profile of this issue and get people involved again. Just a few years after we had budget surpluses, I think people thought the problem had been solved. Mm-hmm. You know, hasn't your disease been cured? Why are you people still around? And what we were trying to say is, no, this is a very serious problem, and it's just going to get worse. So that was actually the birth of the fiscal wake-up tour, which we did roughly from 2005 to 2010.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Diane Lim during our now recurring segment, The Economist Mom. We touched on the fiscal and budget policies of the Clinton and Bush administrations, but ran out of time. So I think we'll talk about the Obama and the first couple of years of the Trump administration with you both in a couple of weeks. Thank you for joining the show once again, Diane and Bob.
Thank you, Chase.
We look forward to hearing from The Economist Mom again, and we'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. My esteemed colleague, Steve Wynn, recently wrote a piece on 7 reasons for everyday Americans to worry about high federal deficits, and they're worth your and policymakers' attention. The fiscal year 2018 federal budget deficit hit $779 billion, and it's projected to grow. It's a good time to think about some of the reasons why you should care about such high government borrowing. And I'm not talking about the need for a slash-and-burn on spending policies or an enormous spike in taxes. I'm just telling you why we should not have such a large and growing budget deficit at this time. Reason number 1. Higher deficits mean more of your tax dollars will be used just to pay interest on the national debt. The interest cost on the debt is going up at a faster rate than any other part of the federal budget.
This results from a combination of more debt and rising interest rates. The more we pay in interest, the less money will be available for current and future needs, ranging from disaster assistance and medical research to law enforcement and the military. As I mentioned earlier, the CBO projects that interest on the debt will exceed defense spending by 2023. In fact, it's projected to exceed all domestic discretionary spending by 2025. Reason number two, high federal deficits put upward pressure on interest rates, which, if they go too high, could slow economic growth, lower salaries, risk recessions, cause job losses, and lower U.S. living standards. When the government borrows money, it is competing for investment dollars that the private sector might put to better use. And estimates project that federal debt increases will reduce family incomes in the coming decades by thousands of dollars a year. Reason number three, we are passing on an enormous financial burden to younger Americans. Parents and grandparents often talk about wanting their families to do well. Yet excessive government borrowing means unfairly saddling younger workers, teenagers, children, and even future generations with liabilities from the past. Reason number four, bigger deficits will make it more difficult to repair Medicare and Social Security. These two programs are critically important to Americans of all ages, but the programs are on unsustainable paths. Just ask their own trustees. The U.S. population is aging, more people are qualifying for benefits, and healthcare costs are rising. Fixing these programs will be expensive, and Washington should be creating some fiscal space for this work rather than digging itself deeper into debt. Reason number five, growing deficits may force the nation's hand, requiring large tax increases or spending cuts at some point in the future. The country's fiscal difficulties will likely require a combination of spending cuts and tax increases. But many politicians talk as though spending cuts alone are the answer, and that eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse will cure all or most of our ills. That's low-hanging fruit that we can't even agree to pick, and it's unrealistic at best. The same is true for the assumption that we could just tax the rich to solve all of our fiscal problems. The larger the fiscal gap, the more severe the changes will be needed to close it, and the higher the likelihood that a combination of spending reductions and revenue increases will be necessary. Reason number six, rising federal deficits could create instability in the financial markets, making it difficult for Americans to invest, to buy homes, send their children to college, and save for retirement. If the federal borrowing continues on its current path or increases in accordance with many of the policy options favored by politicians in both major parties, confidence in the U.S. government's fiscal credibility could at some point falter, leading investors to demand much higher interest rates. That could produce some ugly financial surprises for millions of Americans. And finally, reason number seven. High deficits could make it more difficult for Washington to deal with unanticipated emergencies that could affect virtually everyone. These emergencies could range, for example, from military or environmental crises to another Great Recession that requires massive government spending to prevent an economic meltdown. If Washington is already deep in debt and borrowing heavily, it will be far more difficult to find the political will necessary to deal with future emergencies. Earlier this month, Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell agreed with many economists who worry that Washington's heavy borrowing could make it more difficult to counteract the next economic downturn. Frankly, there are probably more than seven reasons why you should care about our nation's large and growing budget deficits. At the very least, our policymakers should care. That is why it's troubling that elected officials don't seem to bat an eye at the government's own projections of rapidly rising deficits in the years ahead, topping $1 trillion as early as next fiscal year, even at a time when our economy is growing. And that's just under current policy, not as a result of any number of additional tax cuts or spending increases proposed by elected leaders and candidates. This strong economy is a good time for Washington to start lowering deficits, fixing programs like Social Security and Medicare, engaging in responsible bipartisan tax reform, and turning their eyes to sustaining long-term economic growth. This short-term, quick political win policy perspective from both sides of the aisle is merely delaying the inevitable and making it more difficult to engage in realistic and lasting reform. We can do better. Current and future generations are depending on it. You have been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.